always be clear where you get your conservative talk.
The St. Louis Business Journal is now reporting that liberal billionaire George Soros is the largest shareholder of Odyssey,
the parent company of KMOX and 97.1 Talk.
Soros' maneuver raises critical questions about the future of media ownership and influence.
Money and attention is power. And when he has the money and he controls what's on the radio stations, he's going to be able to control the minds, essentially hundreds of millions of Americans.
St. Louis's trusted source and number one.
For conservative talk.
This is News Talk STL.
For podcast articles and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
Good afternoon. Welcome into the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show here at 101.9 94.1 News Talk STL on a scorcher of an afternoon, but it's all cool inside here at the big radio station. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. This is the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show along with producer Joey V. Chris, we've got two very special guests here in the studio to help kick the show off with us today because we have an awesome event tonight. Tickets, there's still some available. It's nice and cool inside the Funny Bone at St. Charles, and we'd love for everybody to join us.
Tim, the day has finally arrived, 25th of June. We've got two rock stars here with us, Zach Smith and Joel Griffith from the Heritage Foundation. We're going to have a heck of an event tonight at the Funny Bone, and I can't wait to get started. We always have a lot of fun at these events, and we love meeting the people when they come out and see these events, and everyone gets entertained and educated.
Huge news on the wires that all of our local shows have been covering today here on the number one station for live and local conservative talk, including an update on the Trump gag order. We'll discuss that a little bit with Zach Smith, including some new economic numbers that are coming out. We'll discuss that with Joel Griffith. Folks, if you want to join us tonight, you can still do that. If you have time, go to newstalkstl.com and just register. Tickets are free. If you don't have time, we would still love you to come by. We'll definitely try to fit you in. I think we can make that happen. But it is going to be a huge crowd tonight at the St. Charles Funny Bone at the streets of St. Charles. We want to thank the Heritage Foundation very much for Corinne and the gang for sending Joel and Zach with us to be with us tonight. Yeah. And we want to thank West News Magazine, Mid Rivers News Magazine, and the St. Louis Young Republicans all for sponsoring the program. All right, we've got these two fellas here in this hour. David Stokes at 4:45 from the Show Me Institute. Then we're going to have the speaker stump speech at 5:07 and more from the Heritage Foundation in our second hour as well. So without further ado, we have our perennial, our weekly friend, Zach Smith from the Heritage Foundation. He's live in studio with us again.
I feel like we should play his theme.
Maybe we could do that.
Maybe I could do a live rendition.
There it is. There it is.
You are out of order. The whole trial is out of order.
Zach Smith, legal fellow with the Heritage Foundation.
You know, I ask you a lot of predictions. Can you predict what the Supreme Court probably will do with this action?
And now
it's official.
And now Joel Griffith is wondering, why orders my theme? Yeah, right? You're like, I want a theme now, don't
Wait
you?
For it.
Yeah, exactly. Zach, how about we kick it off with the big news of the day? The Trump gag order has been massaged, I guess, to an extent. The fact that one exists just rubs me raw, and I'm sure it does you as well as a practicing. Or are we both recovering? I'm definitely recovering. You're kind of recovering. You're kind of recovering, Laura.
Trying
to recover. Zach, the idea that we're going to violate the first, probably the sixth, maybe the Fourth Amendment rights of a criminal defendant, is, or of any American citizen, is anathema to me, and it should be to everyone, whether you're on the right or the left. So the fact that this thing still exists after the trial is over bugs me.
Right.
And the fact that they haven't just released it, this judge just loves to gig Donald Trump, doesn't he?
Well, look, we've talked about it before. The gag order from the outset was problematic. Typically, judges are very hesitant to issue a gag order in any criminal proceeding because of the very real First Amendment concerns that exist. And any of those First Amendment concerns are certainly amplified here with Donald Trump, who's currently running to be president of the United States. And so the fact that this gag order, it's been massaged, it's been reduced, but it's still in place. The fact that this gag order is still in place as Donald Trump campaigns for the presidency, as he prepares prepares to head into the first debate on Thursday night is very, very problematic. I saw someone earlier on X, formerly Twitter, post, you know, what's Donald Trump supposed to do? Is he supposed to have his lawyers on speed dial from the debate stage, getting the nod for what he can and cannot say? That's certainly no way a candidate can run a campaign. And I think it should trouble us all that this gag order was put in place to begin with, but it should really trouble us that it remains in place.
You know, the next big story of the day was the deal with Julian Assange, who seems to have is going to get a 4 or 5 years served in England. I think he had a plea deal today in America, Samoa, somewhere like that, so he didn't want to set foot on American soil. I don't know how about you, but I have never looked at Julian Assange as a hero in exposing the American government. I think he put a lot of people's lives in danger. I think he broke the law. He stole classified documents, and I think he should be prosecuted. And I'm just wondering, and I want both of you guys to talk about this, I'm just wondering, is our government letting him go because he has so much dirt on so many people in this government, and they're just like, we don't want to touch this with a 10-foot pole. You kind of go away. We'll say you time served. Or what do you think? This just seems like he's getting off kind of easy, even though I know he lived in an embassy for 5 years, and that can't be easy. But he seems to be getting off pretty easy here to me.
Well, I'm glad you saved the non-controversial questions for when I'm here in person, Chris. Nothing tough to talk about. Look, I think if you look at the factual allegations that are made in this plea agreement that Julian Assange agreed to, they're very troubling. Certainly, the lives of American servicemen were put in danger by the information that Julian Assange sought and then released. He has become kind of a cause célèbre for some on the right today. So there can be good faith disagreement about that, but I think the undisputed facts are that the information he released put the lives of American servicemen and women at risk and undermined our national security interests.
Joel, you're a recovering attorney as well. We don't want to leave you out, so we got Attorney Central here today in the studio with us.
I'm not getting off easy on this one either, I see. No, I don't view Julian Assange as a hero. Yeah. This is a man who stole information, not just stole information, but information that quite likely put American lives in jeopardy, including a number of individuals who put their lives in line, who made a profession trying to protect us from foreign enemies. And for this man to be celebrated and to celebrate his early release, it's just something I cannot be a part of. And I think it's an absolute shame that this man, who, from what I can tell, was actually a traitor to his own country, that this man is going to be walking free. And, you know, there's a big part of the base on the far, far left that is opposed to this country, that is celebrating this. And, you know, Julian Assange is known to be someone who is hostile to American interests, and now he'll be walking free.
Do any of you two want to put any odds or bets on will Julian Assange be alive 1 year from now?
George, Tim, go ahead. I don't want to put
that's
these guys
a little
on the
macabre.
Yeah.
Well, I said, tough stuff today, Chris.
I think somebody's going to get him personally.
Zach Smith, senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation, co-host of the SCOTUS 101 podcast, is our guest in studio, along with Joel Griffith, research fellow for economic policy studies at the Heritage Foundation. Joel, Shark Tank star Kevin O'Leary today slams the Wasteland, formerly known as San Francisco, over their store closures, crime run rampant, bad policies. He says it's not America anymore. I guess wake up and smell the coffee, right, Joel? Because I think you've known that for a long time. Having you're now a refugee, or you were a refugee from California before you immigrated to the United States.
That's right. Yeah. Now, when I was living in California, I was living in Orange County, which, as you know, is very conservative and has wonderful mayors across the southern part of the county that keep crime under control. And it's sad what has happened in San Francisco, not just with the soft on crime policies from the judges all the way down to the prosecutors, but in terms of the business climate as well. There's a reason why these office vacancies are near all-time highs. And while commercial real estate in many of those neighborhoods has actually plunged by upwards of 30% over the past few years. And look, if you're living in California, it's one thing to live in a wonderful area like Orange County where at least you're safe, but you still have to fork over nearly half of your income to the federal government and the state income tax. Being a place in San Francisco where not only do you have to forfeit over half of your income to the state, local, and federal government, but you also have no real right to defend yourself, and you're at a very real risk of vandalism or, of course, far worse, physical injury or death.
This question for Joel. Joel, earlier this year, we had a number of small banks around the country that folded. People were worrying, was there a potential banking crisis? The Federal Reserve was looking at requiring these banks to have more capital to cover any losses. Federal Reserve today announced that they weren't going to be as aggressive in requiring more capital for these banks. Does this mean that the banking system is more stronger and banks are better, or what's going on?
No, it's a great question. Well, a big part of the problem that happened with the bank failures of around a year ago were that banks had parked a lot of their money in U.S. government debt mm-hmm. and other so-called safe assets. And although our government continues to make interest payments on the debt, as inflation skyrocketed, the value of those future interest rate payments mm-hmm. plunged, right? If you buy a bond right. and it pays you 4% long-term and inflation goes to 6%, suddenly that 4% stream of income is not worth as much. And right. what happened is they had all those hundreds of billions of dollars mm-hmm. of government bonds on the books. And as inflation soared and as the Fed tried to counter their own mistake by right. raising rates, caused the value of those bonds to plummet, meaning that if people would have actually, depositors would have actually asked for their money back and the bank would have had to sell those government right. bonds, they would have had to sell the government bonds at far less than face value. Mm. This is a problem of the federal government's own choosing okay. or of the Federal Reserve's own creation. Now, sure. your question regarding these new changes to the capital requirements, mm. what the Federal Reserve is trying to do is they were trying to count mortgage assets on the books as less valuable than before. That would have actually been an awful change to the regulation, and I'm thankful the Federal Reserve is actually backing down okay. from that change.
I was just saying, but if housing prices have lowered, I mean, shouldn't those assets be less valuable?
No, so you're right that as you see the housing bubble continue mm-hmm. to inflate, that is making some of those mortgages more risky. Mm-hmm. But we also know that the banks, by and large, are passing these stress tests that they have to pass okay. Each and every year, and that they have, for the most part, ample capital requirements to withstand a housing downturn if there were to be a foreclosure crisis. And what this proposal regulation would have done would be to force banks to hold on to more capital relative to the mortgages that they own. Okay. And it would have put them at a competitive disadvantage to European banks that had far less stringent capital requirements. It would have hurt our own domestic banking sector.
Okay. Question for both of you. And Zach, you can take the lead on this one because it was a Supreme Court decision from last week that I think we may have touched on briefly, but the ramifications of this could be far-reaching. The case that was supposed to determine the question on whether or not unrealized gains can be taxed. And before people let their eyeballs glaze over and tune us out, Zach, this will affect almost all, any American who works for a living, has a 401k, right. a pension plan. This is not just a case that could affect the Wall Street day traders and the fat cats, right? This is something that could affect everyone. And it sounds to me like a massive jobs improvement plan for CPAs and lawyers. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but it also sounds like a logistical nightmare. Could you explain a little about this? And then Joel, maybe talk about the economic, how this is going to hit people in their wallet.
Yeah, so this is Moore versus United States is the case. Essentially, what happened in this case, the Moores own stock in an overseas corporation. It was actually a quasi-charitable entity that dug wells for underserved communities in India and other places as well. And what happened is several years ago, Congress passed a supposedly one-time tax, repatriation-type tax, that would tax the unrealized gains on corporate income that was currently overseas. And so the Moores challenged this, essentially saying that if the income had never been realized, for instance, if they never received the stock or the income from the corporation, but instead just kept reinvesting it into the company, the Moores said that there wasn't a taxable event, and that because of that, the Constitution would require the tax to be apportioned equally among the states. Now, you can get into some fairly complex and arcane legal arguments about what that means for a direct tax to be apportioned among the states. That's really not an issue today because the 16th Amendment was passed in the early 20th century that essentially allowed for the direct income taxation of individuals' income. But essentially, the court dodged the exact question that the Moores brought before it. But the key thing to remember is that in this case, the court's decision could leave open the door potentially to a future wealth tax. And this is something that many people, I know Joel has talked about this before, that could be, it from a legal standpoint, not only very problematic, but also from an economic standpoint as well.
Further comment on that?
Yeah, so in addition to what
I mean, most people put money in their 401k and they let it ride for 20 or 30 years. This could actually cause people to have to file tax returns on gains in those portfolios, right, without them pulling the money out.
Great. Now, of course, the other side is going to say, well, we're only going to be levying this tax, whether a tax on unrealized gains or otherwise, on the ultra wealthy.
Right.
But there's a big problem here. Number, if we go back 100 and something years and the income tax is first implemented via constitutional amendment, that only impacted the top 5% or so of income earners. And of course, we know that the vast majority of us now have to pay that tax. The pro, once the precedent is set, all it takes is a piece of congressional legislation to expand it to everyone. But there's a bigger problem here. When we're talking about taxing unrealized gains, the next step is simply a wealth tax itself, a tax like you pay on your residential property each year. And the left, including Senator Warren, has already been very clear about this, and a number of world leaders, that they want to tax not just the gains, not just the unrealized gains. They want to tax your stash of wealth itself. This would be a confiscation of private property. And even if it were to only affect the wealthy initially, that will impact all of us, because when we're talking about taxing capital itself, it is that capital itself that continues to course through our economy's veins, allowing us all to be more productive each and every year. When you begin to siphon off that capital and divert it to the government, that's less capital that is there, and capital reproduces itself. We take that capital away, it means we're all going to be less productive. It ends up hurting not just the wealthy, it hurts the middle class as well.
Sounds like communism to me.
Joel, there are plenty of liberals that are on, that are listening to our show right now, that have a Keynesian philosophy, and will say, well, we can just print more money. That seems to be kind of the prevailing economic thought now around the world, is print a lot of money, spend, and the economic growth will make up for it.
Right now, I encourage people, look at a chart of the Federal Reserve assets that represents how much money the Fed has digitally printed. And it looks like a hockey stick. It steadily increases for several decades, and then it just takes off during the final 2 years of the Trump administration. It continues to grow into the Biden administration. We are dealing with Keynesianism on steroids due to the Fed printing all that money to fund the government expansion. We're experiencing that now. And long term, I think we're going to see more of the same as our politicians refuse to address our entitlement crisis.
4:22 in the PM. We've got lots more to talk about with the guys here. And you can come out if you have enjoyed all this wit and fantastic wisdom. You can get more of it tonight in person. Come out and join us, folks, at the St. Charles Funny Bone. We promise the AC is working just fine. It's in the beautiful environs of the streets of St. Charles. Lots to do and see in that area as well. Come out and see us tonight. Doors open at 6:30. The event's at 7. We will take audience participation questions as well. We'll be right back continuing our conversation with Zach Smith and Joel Griffith of the Heritage Foundation with Chris, Joey, and I. More next here at 101.9/94.1. This is News Talk STL.
For podcast articles and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
Biden administration's student loan repayment plan is facing more legal challenges. Two federal court judges in Kansas and Missouri have paused parts of the so-called SAVE plan. It lowered monthly payments for borrowers and provided a route to debt forgiveness. Lawsuits filed in Kansas and Missouri argued the Biden administration overstepped its authority when implemented the SAVE plan. The move blocks the administration from canceling any more federal student debt for SAVE borrowers or implementing new provisions to the plan while the cases are litigated.
4:28 on the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show. And in studio with us is, of course, Zach Smith, Senior Legal Fellow of the Heritage Foundation and co-host of the SCOTUS 101 podcast, and Joel Griffith, Research Fellow for Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. They are in town and in studio with us tonight because we will be having our Saving America event at the Funny Bone in St. Charles. There are still tickets available, not many, but still available. Perfect. The Legal Eagle. And I have a question for the Legal Eagle. Zach, I have literally lost track how many of these student loan cases have gone to the Supreme Court and have been overturned. I'm not an attorney. I'm here with three attorneys here. But is there something like Supreme Court can do and say these are like frivolous lawsuits and fine them some money or something? Because these cases, they get overturned. We know they're going to get overturned, right, but they're doing it, of course, we know, for political reasons.
Well, I feel so bad for you, Chris, being here with three lawyers. Nobody deserves that type of punishment. But look, you're absolutely right. Keep in mind, Joe Biden, the Biden administration, he's repeatedly said, I know I don't have the power to do this, but I'm going to do it anyway. And this latest student loan case, it's kind of like deja vu all over again, because just recently, the Supreme Court in Biden versus Nebraska said that the Biden administration didn't have the authority under the HEROES Act and the Higher Education Act, but primarily the HEROES Act, a COVID-19 related statute, to forgive massive amounts, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of student loans. And so what the Biden administration did, they pivoted and say, okay, we'll do the exact same thing, just citing another very attenuated statutory basis to do so. And so essentially what these two federal judges today is they issued preliminary injunctions. It's not a final ruling on the merits, but what they said is we think the states challenging the student loan forgiveness plan will likely succeed once we go through the full trial and hearing and everything. And so they stopped these student loan plans from taking effect in the meantime.
Joel, we are barely 48 hours away from the first presidential debate. I'm not going to ask you to make any predictions as to that unless you'd like to, but I will bet you one of the things we're going to hear a lot about is the economy. And we're likely going to hear two very different versions of the economy if Joe Biden can stay awake through the full 90 minutes. The Biden administration has been telling us for the past 3.5 years that everything that they've done has improved the lives of everyday Americans, that happy days are here again. They've called inflation everything from imaginary to transitory and everything in between. They use that top line number, Joel, of unemployment to basically say everything that they want about the economy. They go no further. But I'll bet a guy like you looks under the hood and says, don't believe their lying eyes.
Yeah, I think we should all be trusting our own selves and our families on this. And guess what? The data actually back up the fact that this is the most difficult economy for American families dating back to the late 1970s. And let's just take one of the statistics that President Biden likes to throw around every month, and that's jobs creation. We know that almost each and every month, the jobs numbers show 200,000 plus new jobs created. Well, that's true. There's more jobs. But if you look at the number of people working full time, that number has been on a steady downward trajectory. The last year, we've lost more than 1 million full-time jobs. So how can both things be true? We have more jobs, and that's true, but we have fewer people working full-time. That's true as well.
That labor participation rate, right? Well,
there are more people working two jobs to make ends meet. The number of part-time jobs are skyrocketing because people are having a hard time paying the bills, which comes down to another big number that's always thrown out is wages are up. Yes, wages as a whole are up, but wages adjusted for inflation, what your wages can buy, that is down. And for the typical middle class two-income family, real wages are down in terms of what your money can buy by $5,000 a year over the last few years. And that's not even taken into account credit card debt costs. Those are up about $1,500 a family per year. And that $5,000 cut in real income does not even take into account the real rise in housing costs. And if you look to buy a home, you know that the mortgage payment on a standard middle class home has gone from around $1,200 a month to closer to $2,700 a month over the past 3 years. That's why Americans are sour on the economy, despite a few of these top line numbers appearing good.
That is Joel Griffith. He's the research fellow for economic policy studies at the Heritage Foundation. And Zach Smith, senior legal fellow of the Heritage Foundation, is with us as well. And of course, they're going to be with us tonight at the Funny Bone. Joel, I got a question for you. The president last week proposed at a rally eliminating the taxes on tips for servers. A liberal think tank said that'll cost the economy, the government, $150 billion. Your economic thoughts on that proposal?
Well, look, as a former bartender and a server for years, I know what it's like to earn that $2.13 an hour plus minimum wage plus the tips. I think the intentions here are good. But keep in mind, there's around 6 million people, give or take, that right now earn tipped income. And many of those individuals don't pay income tax because they're beneath the income threshold. What this would do would also, the proposal to eliminate tips from taxation would also eliminate them from responsibility to pay the payroll tax for Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. I can understand why this is a political winner, but we have to understand that what we would be doing is we'd be exempting about 2 or 3% of the workforce from paying payroll taxes and income tax. And it would end up meaning that about 97% of the population would go ahead and basically subsidize that because somebody has to make up the cost of those payments not being
made. And is there a constitutional issue there with a tax seems to be focused on one particular group.
You know, there are so many carve-outs in the tax code, and so long as Congress approves those, there's usually not a constitutional problem. What I hope the president will do, and I know he, former President Trump will do, and he's remained committed to this, is ensuring that the wonderful Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that reduced income taxes, that reduced capital gains, reduced taxes on businesses, he wants to extend those and actually deepen those. And that would be a boon for the economy. We saw those results during the prior administration. You know, when President Trump left office, right before the pandemic anyway, our tax revenue as a percentage of GDP was near all-time highs, despite the fact that taxes were cut. And that's because the economy was booming. And I'm pleased to know that President Trump is committed to extending those tax cuts, making them permanent, and even making them bigger.
Zach, there is a likely going to be a big docket dump from the Supreme Court, right, over the next 72 hours.
To put it mildly,
as pleasant as that sounds. However, Zach, one of those cases is going to be one that you and I and Chris have talked about for, man, it seems like years now. And those are the cases that are taking on the dreaded Chevron doctrine. I believe there's at least two, if not three, cases involved that made it all to the Supreme Court. I know this is something that Justice Gorsuch is likely going to write the hopefully majority opinion on. And he could really kneecap and curtail the Chevron doctrine. And Zach, that is good. That could be potentially good for all small business owners in the country, couldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. The two cases that made it up to the court are the Loper-Bright and the Relentless case. They involve fishermen in New England, the East Coast fisheries. But look, the ruling that the Supreme Court is going to enter on this is going to impact small businesses. It's going to impact nearly every industry in the country. And I think that's really a testament to the overregulation that so many industries that we as Americans are experiencing right now. But the law as it currently stands requires federal judges to give deference to unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats on what our laws mean. And to me, that seems like an untenable position to maintain. Now, you mentioned Justice Gorsuch may write the opinion. It's always interesting reading the tea leaves to see what opinions are outstanding, how many opinions different justices have written. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the point in the term where everybody is prognosticating. I will say, if Justice Gorsuch ends up writing this opinion, it'd be somewhat ironic in a good way, because you may remember his mother was the EPA administrator during the Ronald Reagan administration, during the early years. And so she was certainly familiar with many of the trials and tribulations that go into this regulatory regime we currently have. I suspect Justice Gorsuch learned something from his own mother's experience as the head of the EPA. But look, over the next 3 days, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, those are going to be the last 3 days of this Supreme Court term. They always end before the 1st of July. And we're going to get a lot of big cases, the Chevron cases. We're going to get several big tech First Amendment cases, the net choice cases, Murphy versus Missouri right here out of Missouri. And then, of course, the Trump immunity case is going to come down as well.
Mm-hmm. This question is for both of you. The legal ramifications and the economic ramifications. President Trump proposed last week that everyone who gets a college degree should be eligible for a green card. The legalities of that, Zach, and the economic impact of that, Joel. Whoever wants to go first?
Well, look, I mean, this is certainly within Congress's power to do that. I think many are rightly concerned if that were to be the case, because right now we don't currently enforce the immigration laws that are on the books. Mm-hmm. I think Merrick Garland, Alejandro Mayorkas, they've absolutely abdicated their duties to enforce our southern border. It's essentially an open border at this point, which has let in millions of illegal aliens that not only have economic impacts, but also, frankly, has created a national security crisis in our country, because we don't know who is coming across our southern border. And so, again, while I'm sure President Trump's intentions are well intentioned with that proposal, I think many are rightly concerned and are hoping that he will remain focused, as he has been and has been a strong advocate for, to securing our southern border and making sure that those individuals who came to our country illegally essentially skip the process that is the legal immigration process we have, who have tried to benefit from that, that he will focus on deporting many of those individuals and making them go through the right process if they want to come back to our country.
Joel?
There's a lot of value in expanding immigration opportunities to those who are graduating from universities here. Now, this shouldn't be a one-size-fits-all policy where just because you have a college degree, you should be granted access. There should be a thorough vetting process that goes beyond even the major study that goes beyond that. I mean, you think of all that's happening on our college campuses right now with so many of our guests here that are rioting, vandalizing synagogues, blockading lecture halls, in many ways terrorizing students. Those types of individuals should never be allowed access to permanency here, right. And they should, in fact, be immediately deported. But if we're talking about those that are in learning about chemical engineering or medicine or business in general, many of those individuals, if they were able to stay here, would become very valuable members of our country. And even if they're not citizens, contributors to the growth of our economy. You know, our economy is not a fixed pie. When you have people come in with intellect and with drive that want to apply their skills to capital, that means more jobs creation. It means more wealth for all of us. And so I think there's a lot of value to what President Trump is proposing in allowing more of those students to graduate from universities here to actually stay, earn a living, and help our economy grow.
If you want to hear more of that wisdom, you can hear it tonight at the Funny Bone, Saving America, News Talk STL, 101.9, 94.1. They will be with us at the Funny Bone. Guys, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Look forward to get you freshen up there, get you a fresh cocktail, and be ready for an engaging discussion tonight. Thank you guys for coming in.
Thanks for having us on.
Thanks, fellas, very much.
When we come back, David Stokes, Director of Municipal Policy at the Show Me Institute, will talk about St. Louis. Looking to reimburse $26 million in earnings taxes to remote workers. You're listening to the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show on 101.9, 94.1 News Talk STL, Soros Free Radio.
For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on NewsTalkSTL.com.
Late last month, the Missouri Court of Appeals ruled the city of St. Louis must repay the 1% earnings tax it collected on workers who worked remotely from outside the city during the pandemic. Starting July 1st through September 20th, 2024, eligible taxpayers can apply for a refund for tax years 2020, 21, and 22. The 2023 refund window will remain open through April 15th, 2025.
448, welcome back to the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show. Listen to that clip, Tim. I started thinking about something. Mm-hmm. The mayor has proposed a program to help people pay their personal property taxes, to pay their back water bills, to pay back their rent. Mm-hmm. I wonder how much that total adds up to, because they need to give city workers $26 million of their money back. And I'm wondering, I'd be very curious if that equals up to the same amount or more what they're giving away and what they owe the people. Let's ask our next guest about that. I'm sure he has that knowledge tucked in his brain.
David Stokes over at the Show Me Institute.
In high school, you talk about spikes. I had a very short spiked.
It was I knew there was some spike somewhere in that stuff.
It wasn't very punky. It was more Leave It to Beaver-ish, maybe.
Dave, the three election year politic programs that the mayor has proposed to give away taxpayer money, do you think it's more equal to the $26 million that the city owes taxpayers and workers?
No, it's not. I think the one thing you can say about all those various programs and a few more that the mayor has proposed is that they are all fairly small amounts of money, which I guess is good. I mean, that is good, but it makes you think that they're really more about politics than anything else. Because even if these programs were beneficial, and they're not going to be, maybe the exception of paying the homeless to clean up trash.
Yeah.
That's,
well, I forgot about that program.
That's by far, right. There's been so many of these new ones.
I forgot about that one.
That's the only one that's sort of defensible and understandable. That's probably why you forgot about it.
Exactly.
How could they do a good one? But all the others are so small, it makes you think that they really are just about more about the political effect of being able to claim you did it than actually accomplishing something. Because all these programs, you know, they're just, each one is more preposterous than the next. Giving people government money to pay their water bills, which in the city of St. Louis is a government agency. So it's taking, robbing Peter to pay Paul. You know, it's the same with license plates. We're going to give you tax money so you can pay your taxes and register your car for a few months before it's up for renewal, and you then forget to do that. So it's all give from the right, take from the left, or vice versa. But it's not going to accomplish anything, and it's nowhere near the amount of money that they have been improperly taking from remote workers in the city of St. Louis for 4 years now.
And David, where's all this money coming from? Did they finally invent the money tree in the city of St. Louis?
Well, I think the Rams were the money tree, okay, at least temporarily. Okay. The Rams were the true money tree with hundreds of millions.
These are ongoing programs, though, right?
Well, they're using ARPA money and CARES Act federal funds. Remember, however they made these federal equations to determine which cities and counties based on all sorts of different calculations and rates, the city of St. Louis was like, got more per capita than like any place in America on these federal funds, mm-hmm, from the Biden administration, which I'm sure some people are happy about. So they received, I think it was $500 million in these various funds, where by comparison, I think St. Louis County got about $170 million. I mean, the numbers are astronomical. Then you throw in the Rams money, the couple hundred million the city received there. For the last couple of years, the last thing in the world the city of St. Louis can say is that they don't have the money to do what they want. They have plenty of money. They have for years, and until they run out of this Rams money and the stimulus money, which may be soon, they've had it. And have they spent it on trying to attract and retain new police, the one thing they desperately need? Yeah, they've probably done a little bit of that, but they've also done, which we talked about at the start, mm-hmm, we're going to do new water. We're going to do a guaranteed income program. We're going to pay your water bill if you can't pay it. We're going to register your car if you can't afford to do that. They're just throwing money away to, I'm not going to say it, but, you know, there's an election coming up.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Oh, it is my turn. Sorry about that. Dave, we talked a couple of weeks ago about the University City, the renovation. Now it became kind of controversial, this plan that they had to finance this. I'm going to take credit for that, you and I both, because we talked about this. It seems like there is going to be some changes to this plan. Can you talk more about that?
But the changes, in a manner of speaking, I think are almost even
really
worse.
Okay, tell us about it.
No, oh, it is. Because what they're doing in order to get around this lawsuit, which is in order to rehabilitate a few city-owned buildings, mm-hmm, near City Hall and the library, they come up with a plan where they're going to do the bonds, and they're going to pay for it by leasing out city-owned equipment, right, to the bank, and then they're going to pay that and just sort of buy that leased equipment back over time. Mm-hmm. And it's going to have a lot of interest payments and all to it. But it's in violation of a charter amendment the voters passed in University City, where we both live,
yeah,
that says anything like that has to go to a vote of the people. So now, in order to get around that lawsuit, what they're doing is they're making very certain that all the stuff that's being leased, mm-hmm, to the bank that they're going to buy back over time is not fixed equipment. Like, it's nothing, like, it's not the building. It's all just the furniture and the
office
electronics
equipment
and the office equipment. It's all stuff that they say now, well, that's definitely not covered by this charter amendment. And why I think it's worse is that it's so obviously and transparently a way to get around the plain meaning of the law when the voters passed it. And I don't remember it exactly 7-8 years, but I'm pretty sure I didn't even vote for this law 7-8 years ago. Cause I would have been opposed to some, you know, I don't like doing everything by vote. I think elected council members should make these decisions. So that said, trying to so nakedly get around what the voters passed with an even more legalistic interpretation of it, I think may be legally correct and might help them win the lawsuit, but I think it's going to more upset the voters because it's not doing their will.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
David, speaking of lawsuits.
So much to talk about.
Yeah. Speaking of lawsuits, the earnings tax debate, St. Louis is set to reimburse $26 million. David, long term, and we've talked about this before, but I think it's always good to remind folks, this is something, the earnings tax itself, it needs to go away. That's one. There's no silver bullet solution for the problems that St. Louis is facing, but encouraging people not to live and work there due to excessive taxation is one of them, isn't it?
Absolutely. And as I said when I spoke to the City Charter Commission several weeks ago, you know, the best time to have started getting rid of the earnings tax was 20 years ago. The second, it's like planting a tree. The best time to do it was 20 years ago. The second best time is today. And nobody says it's going to be easy, and nobody is suggesting that it could be done in a year or two. But you can start a phase out, be it a 10 or even a 15 or 20 year phase out of that tax to start moving in a direction to get away from it. And what the city of Kansas City showed over time for the immediate effect of the remote work is that it wasn't nearly as bad as they feared. So that sort of made what the city did even more indefensible, because they had Kansas City's experience 3 years ago, yet they kept collecting it from remote workers and kept driving, because they did that, businesses out of the city of St. Louis. And what do I mean by that? Not necessarily large companies moved to do that, but if you had a business with a lot of remote workers, all you had to do, and I know some businesses that did this, was open up a little satellite office in the county.
Yep.
Then all of a sudden, all your remote workers could report to work at that satellite office in the county, and it didn't have to be big, it didn't have to be costly, and now they could really get around the earnings tax, and now they really stopped coming into the city, because now they would go to that satellite office. Mm-hmm. So it's just an example of how it hurts the city. You know, every time I hear supporters of it say how lots of cities have the earnings tax, or have earnings taxes, or local income taxes, as they're commonly called. Earnings tax is a Missouri phrase. You just want to get up and throttle. You just want to shake people.
Rhetorically.
Rhetorically, shake people, of course, and say, look, outside of Ohio and Pennsylvania, local income taxes are very, very rare. Two states where they're common, 48 states where they're incredibly rare. Mm-hmm. There's only really eight or nine states that allow them at all. Again, two of them where they're common throughout the state. The other six are more like Missouri, where a couple of the larger cities have it. And you can never get tired of reminding people that most cities fund themselves without local income taxes, and fund themselves, and this is the part that not everybody's going to want to hear, with higher property taxes. That's how most cities fund themselves. I don't want to say higher sales taxes, because the city of St. Louis has fairly high sales taxes right now. So they need to make up this difference through, first and foremost, some government cuts. They don't need to be doing everything that they are doing. Sharing services with St. Louis County where appropriate, or with other cities. And then phasing it out for higher property taxes or other types of user fees.
Dave, before we let you go...
Well, I was a bit late today, so that's all right. I can stay for the whole 5 o'clock hour, right?
Before we let you go, I want Joey to play Cut 12, and I want to get your thoughts on this, the municipal value of this.
The Muni is preparing to host Dream Girls this week and weekend. When the curtain opens on the second act, there will be a special guest for the shows this weekend. St. Louis Mayor Tishard Jones will appear in Dream Girls.
And your thoughts, David? Is that good for the city there?
That's actually a tradition. I think that Mayor Keel, when the Muni was first formed, I think he starred in a few shows at the time. So I think this is a tradition for Mayor. I don't know if every mayor has done it since, but I think it's great. If Mayor Jones is going to appear in it, we were at the Muni for Les Mis a couple nights ago. It was wonderful.
David Stokes, Director of Municipal Policy, Stump Speech, up next.
For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.